In there, and we'll start talking about meditation objects. All right. Well, welcome to the Saturday morning call. It's Friday evening in the U.S., and I'm very glad to see such a large crowd here today. This is great. So Caleb has a question about meditation objects, and specifically he was asking the question of letting go of a meditation object. And that's kind of a strange question. So let's talk about meditation objects for a little bit. Most of the time, Westerners are confused about meditation objects. And that in fact, let's talk about it in a general sense. And that is that when you are loading a piece of software, downloading and installing software, that's your object, what you're paying attention to. And in that regard, when Caleb asks, can you let go of the object, that's like saying that you're not paying attention to anything. And a much better question would be, what is worth paying attention to? All right. What is worth paying attention to? All right. So the first thing to say about that is that there's a sutta, number two, that's one of the companion suttas for the Anapanasati Sutta, that in fact it helps put things together. It's called the Sabha Asava Sutta, and it's sutta number two. And in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, he has verse numbers. And so I'm actually referring to verse number 11, though many of the translations and the original Pali didn't have verse numbers. But it starts off with the first 10 verses of what is unwise attention. What are the things that we pay attention to that are not worth paying attention to? For instance, a thicket of views. The famous one that a lot of people will think is an object of meditation, and is mostly from Hindu. And we can say that question would be, who am I? What am I? What was I in the past? What will I be in the future? How do I get from where I am now into the future? And all of that stuff, the Buddha says, is unwise attention. Okay, and then he talks about the self, and there's a whole group of statements in the original old Hindi or Brahmanism, in the sense of, is there a self? Is there not a self? Is the self aware of the not self? Is the not self aware of the self, etc., like that? All of this kind of stuff is unwise attention. And what then is wise attention that does not lead to a thicket of views? That you could say, in fact, that the things that are unwise attention, we know they're unwise because they don't lead us to freedom. And that there are some things that are worthy of attention and wise reflection that do lead us to freedom. Okay, and that wise attention that the Buddha talks about then is actually stated in verse 11 is this is suffering. This is dukkha. This is the cause of dukkha. It's really phrased in a way to get us into the point of seeing right here, right now, this, thusness, whatever is happening right now, this is dukkha, this is the cause of dukkha. And then The next line is, this is the end of dukkha. And this is the way to get out of dukkha, which means now that it's wise reflection upon the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Noble Path. This is what is worth paying attention to. Now, in that same line, in that same passage, it says that if one does, in fact, have wise reflection about what is dukkha and what is not dukkha, that goes back to the original statement that is in Sutta number 22, the simile of the snake, where the Buddha says, there's only one thing that I teach, both formally and now, I teach dukkha, dukkha nirodha. And so now in this sutta, he's saying what's worthy of our attention is to see what dukkha is and to see our way out of it immediately. This, right here, right now, is dukkha, and this is getting out of it. And so now we can go to several other suttas, and the first one to introduce would be sutta number 19, where it has two kinds of thought. And in the two kinds of thought, it's talked about that there is wholesome, useful, valuable freedom thoughts. And then there are thoughts that are unwholesome, not valuable, and are not wise. And so we can go then to the sutta number 117, where it talks about the Eightfold Noble Path. And in the regard of the Eightfold Noble Path, it talks about unwholesome thoughts, to remove unwholesome thoughts. And those unwholesome thoughts would be about me, mine, what I want, what I need to get, and to start having wholesome thoughts in the sense of everything is okay, everything is fine. Nobody needs anything. The world is good enough the way that it is. Wow, how nice things really are. And this is really worth our reflection, is to stop having thoughts of dukkha and see our way out of it so that we can start to have thoughts of non-dukkha. So you could say that dukkha is work to do. And dukkha nirodha is the job has been done. That in fact is referred to that way in many suttas, including number 38, where it talks about we become pure as a polished shell, not a valuable gem, just a shell that's been polished. In fact, I think that the oysters do a pretty good job of polishing the inside of their shell all by themselves. And then it says, the job that needed to be done has been done. Well, what is the job to do? The only job there is to do, the right effort that we need to take, is to come out of our unwholesome thoughts into having, intentionally having, wholesome thoughts, to relax. And everybody should do this on a very regular basis. Do it at least once a day. But if you're actually involved with practicing, I would say do it 5 or 6 times a day as you remember, is to stop thinking about the things that you normally think about and start having thoughts about, wow, you know, life is good. Everything is okay. Wow, I'm really glad that I've made it this far. I'm better off right this very minute than I've ever been before. Wow, what trouble I used to have, but I don't have that kind of trouble anymore. Not right now. Whatever does happen, I can handle it. These are the kind of thoughts that we can begin to develop. Intentionally having thoughts of coming out of our dukkha and coming into a state of non-dukkha. Now, the word dukkha actually means satisfying or unsatisfactory or dissatisfying. that we don't like stuff and that we can change our attitude about it. That in fact, the whole quality of not liking stuff is that we feel like that we're a victim to it. The reason you don't like stuff is because you're a victim of it. When you become the champion of it, you don't have that dislike for things anymore. Everything is already okay because you're the boss here anyway. And so having those kind of thoughts that you're already arrived, you've already done the job that needed to be done, and everything is hunky-dory right now. This is what the Buddha teaches. Now, going back to that sutta number 2, the Sabbasava Sutta, that verse number 11, the Buddha says that when you pay wise attention to the Four Noble Truths, to pay wise attention to seeing the dukkha and see the reason for it and to come out of it and to practice coming out of it over and over again, then three fetters are abandoned. Now, we're not saying abandoned in the sense that they're gone forever, because I can do this right now. But we can say that while we're practicing wise reflection, the fetters are abandoned right now. The three number, these are the first three, the important ones. And that is personality view. How, you know, who am I? What am I? And that the best way for people to understand that is instead of using the word anatta or self and no self and not self, a best way to use it to understand it is the issue of selfishness. You all know what we know by being selfish. And so when we're being selfish, when we think, oh, I got to get up and get to work today, that's selfishness. When we have thoughts about today is going to be a good day, everything's going to be just fine today, then that's not being selfish. So, personality view is always a view of I, me, or mine. Bhikkhu Buddhadasa says, and nothing is worth clinging to is I, me, or mine. Everything is just as it is in reality. But if you own something, you're in trouble. If you don't own anything, if you don't own it, then it can be your friend. And so this is the way to take an object, is to take the object of dukkha, dukkha nirodha, to come out of our selfishness. Stop looking at who am I, what am I, what will the future be for me? What was my past? How did I get here? All of those kind of things. Or those kind of questions about what is self? A lot of people will ask that question about what is self. They get confused about anatta and all of that kind of stuff. Then, in fact, what the Buddha was really getting at is that there's no permanent self. Everything keeps changing. Nothing's the way that it used to be, and it's going to continue to change and evolve. And yet the personality view is that I am me. Here's an example of that. I remember when I was 4 years old. I remember an incident that happened when I was four. I remember something that happened when I was 6 years old. Okay? What we do when we're having those kind of thoughts is that we think that we're the same person that we were when we were 4 years old. And you're not at all the same person that you were when you were 4 years old. How can you actually be a person and have a personality when it's a moving target? So a much, much better way of looking at things is to see right now, this is dukkha. Right now, let's come out of selfishness and come into see things the way that they actually are. And that's the first fetter that we can abandon when we're looking at the Four Noble Truths, in the sense that recognizing that selfishness creates dukkha. Tatum, welcome back. So, if we can see this first fetter, we also begin to recognize that something defines who we are. In other words, we've got conditions, we have situations, we have standards, we have rules, and this is the second fetter. And in the Pali, this second fetter is referred to as Sila Bhatta Paramasa. In other words, it's translated kind of badly as attachment to rites, rules, and rituals. Now, in modern psychology, Eric Byrne took the word that Freud used of superego and used the word parent. And this is a good way of understanding is that we got all of our standards and all of our ways of doing things from older people when we were kids. We got it from our folks. We got it from our parents. We got it from our teachers. We got it from our Sunday school teachers. We got it from all kinds of places. And we wound up using this as a collection of set of standards about how things ought to be. And so we wind up in the situation of being selfish is also another word for being childish. And so what defines us is our relationship between what ought to be and what I want it to be. Because we don't like it, we're victims to it. And often we are victims to our own standards. We're victims to our own rules. Like some lady looks in the mirror and she says, "You're fat. You ought to go on a diet." Well, she didn't call herself fat. She's just repeating something that somebody else has said. And so she's giving herself standards and rules, and now she feels bad. That in fact, that's something kind of interesting is that one of the things that the Buddha forbade was mirrors. Now, the reason that they were forbidden was because they were almost always, in those days, made out of highly polished metal. Gold, silver, bronze. And that mirrors could get easily scratched, especially if you're out carrying them around. We have wall mirrors now, but this was not what they had in the time of the Buddha. But also, when we're looking in a mirror, we're actually looking at a me. This is who I am. This is a me there. And so we can see then that when we look in the mirror, we begin to judge ourselves according to some old rules, old standards. Now, here's something very interesting. In the Western culture, they're, let us say, looking at weight ratios, how you're supposed to look. What? How much do you weigh? What is your body mass index? All of this kind of stuff. And yet, when I was in India, way back in the 70s, there was a budding business system called Bollywood. And the stars of the Bollywood movies were almost always fat. Intentionally fat. Why? Because in the old Indian tradition, poor people were thin because they didn't get enough food, and wealthy people got fat. And so fat is good in some cultures, and it's bad in other cultures. Interesting, Right, and yet we've got all of these rules and standards about how fat you should be and all of this, and we always take a selfish attitude about it. Oh, I live up to my standard, or oh, I don't live up to my standard. So this is that second fetter of sila vata paramasa, which is our standards, our rules, our ways of how things are supposed to be. You're not supposed to be fat in this culture, and you're supposed to be fat in that culture. So you can see then that all of these rules primarily are arbitrary. It's what the culture has declined or decided to do. And when we recognize that the rules that we have been brought up with and the rules that we hold to ourselves, we use those things to be critical of our own self. But that's dukkha. We're dissatisfied with ourself because we don't match up to our own standards, our own set of rules. Okay? And so we're going to come back and visit that again in a little while. But let's go now to the third fetter. Because remember that when you have wise reflection about what is dukkha and what is not dukkha, then three fetters are abandoned. And the third fetter is the fetter of doubt. What does that mean? Well, often people who practice meditation, they want to practice it right. And so they'll begin to have a whole lot of questions about how to do it right. And the answer to that is, asking questions about how to do it right is the wrong way to do it. What is the right way to do it is to stop asking questions about how to do it. Just relax. Everybody already knows how to relax. We just don't do it very often. We all know how to have positive, happy thoughts. We just don't do it very often. Why? Because we've already been trained in our culture to be dissatisfied, to be unhappy, to want things that we don't have, to improve, to get better. Guess what? You're already okay right now, just the way you are in this moment. Wow, what a relief that is. You're already enlightened enough. And so we can, in fact, by seeing this issue of the Four Noble Truths, of this is suffering, this is dukkha, and this is coming out of dukkha, we don't have to ask a lot of questions about that. And the doubts all melt away when you're satisfied. The only time that you'll have doubts and worries and frustrations and all of that is when you're in a state of dukkha and you don't even see it. And so the real practice then is to be able to see when you're discomforted, when you're unhappy, when you're dissatisfied. This is the time to practice. And what is the practice? The practice of waking up and seeing that we're dissatisfied and then change that to take the right effort. The right noble effort, which is an item on the Eightfold Noble Path, to take that effort to stop being confused and just be satisfied. To stop being worried and just be satisfied. To stop judging ourselves and just be satisfied. Another word to use would be nurturing, to start nurturing yourself instead of criticizing. Criticizing ourselves means that we've got to change. And what we're talking about here, the change that needs to be made, is to stop trying to change. Just be satisfied with the way things are. Does anybody have any questions about this so far?
Yes, I have one question. You said when you don't see it, or something like that. You said when you don't see it, is that the same as being hindered by it? When you don't see it, you're being hindered by the hindrances. When you just don't see it, like you're blind to it, basically.
Right, exactly. One of the examples of that that you and I have talked about before, and we can bring it up again, is that a lot of the Western people in the practice of the Buddha, they get really gung-ho. They even become monks. They ordain. And then they take on austerities or practices trying to do it right. Okay? You have to eat your food exactly correctly. You have to follow this little rule and that follow this that little rule. Okay? They're trying to get it correct. They're trying to get it right. And the thought is that when they do get it right, then they become satisfied. Well, if they do it wrong again, 5 minutes from now they're back being dissatisfied again. And so the real practice is to practice being satisfied rather than following all the little rules. That in fact, there is a sutta to where one of the monks asked the Buddha, it seems like that in the old days, there were hardly any rules at all and a whole lot of arahats. And now you have all of these rules and there's very few arahats. Why is that? Because all the people who are striving to become an arahat are trying to by following all of these rules. But another way of looking at it is that when you're relaxed, when you're satisfied, when you're okay, when you've got nothing to do, you're not breaking any rules. When you're not doing anything because you're satisfied, then you're not breaking any rules. And so we have two different ways of doing it. We have the ordinary way, which means you got to follow the rules, you got to improve, you got to get things better, you got to start with sila. That in fact, you could say that there are actually two eightfold paths. The first path is ordinary because ordinary people will start to follow the rules. And yet, remember that the rules are a fetter. And so when we start to follow the rules, we start with sila. We want to have perfect behavior. And then we can have perfect concentration or perfect focus. And then we have a perfection of view. Well, basically what perfection of view is all about is to recognize that it doesn't come from following all the rules and it doesn't come from getting the mind concentrated. That basically what right view is, right noble view or perfection of view is perfection of the personality view in the sense of I don't have to follow any rules in order to be happy. I can just be happy. I don't have to attain anything to be happy. I can just be happy. I don't have to go from A to B to C. I can go directly to C. I don't have to do anything in between. So this is the way that we practice. This is the kind of objects that we take. So, if you can understand that, now we can get into a whole group of things that we could call actual meditation objects. And here lies the Anapanasati Sutta with a long list of, in fact, a list of 16 items that we can take as objects of meditation. Now, a lot of people will use the word step. In fact, I was taught 16 steps or 16 stages of Anapanasati, and they're not that way at all. That in fact, you could say 16 items, a list of items, none of which is more important than the others. You've heard this term last but not least. Well, in fact, first is not best. Everything is according to what the Buddha said was one by one as they occur. Now, there is a bit of sequence in there, and the sequence has to do with the first thing that we have to do is to remember to take an object. Isn't that interesting? If we can't take an object, we don't remember to take one. And then what that means is that we've already taken objects, but we don't even look to see what kind of objects we've been taking. We take the object of the coffee cup, or we take the object of the dog, or we take an object of whatever it is that our eyes cast upon, or whatever our hearing says, or whatever we're thinking about. That's the object. But when we remember that we have a choice about what object that we're going to take. And the first one then is to look at looking at. Interesting, huh? The first thing that we do is to remember to really look at what's going on. To remember to look. Is this dukkha? That's the first thing to do. That's wise attention. Remember to have wise attention, to pay attention to, are we dissatisfied? What is it that we're looking at? And can we change that? Instead of just having ordinary thoughts that wind us in kind of an ordinary hell, let's start having wise thoughts. Let's start changing the thoughts that we have into wholesome thoughts. So that's the first thing. And in Anapanasati, the 16 stages, basically, I'm talking about step number 9 and step number 10. So sati means to wake up and look at what the mind is doing, but we're also going to be looking at what the body is doing, what the feelings are doing, what kind of mind objects that we have, and what kind of state of mind that we have. And so we can break down these four objects then, or into four classifications or four groups of objects. Objects that are grouped around the body, objects that are grouped around the feelings, objects that are grouped around our mental state, our attitude, and then the fourth one would be items that are grouped around our thoughts or what we are paying attention to. So if we can see that there are these four major groups of objects, let's start now with the object of the body. So the first thing that we can do is that we can take a deep breath. We can begin to control the body, but by controlling the body, we're already controlling the mind. How are we controlling the mind? Because we remember to take a deep breath. And as we take a deep breath, the body will begin to relax a little bit. We can take a deep breath, the body will relax, and that's the whole point of the body meditation. Then in fact, step 4 of Anapanasati, and again, I call it a step, is actually just an item, is to relax the body. So as you're breathing in long and as you're breathing out long, the whole point of it is just to relax the body. Also to pay attention to what the mind is doing to come out of unwholesome thoughts so that we can relax the mind. Well, if that's the case, then we can go in a little further to say that if we can relax the body and relax the mind in the sense of relaxing the mental state that we're in, and most of the people, most of the time, are in a mental state of being a victim. Oh, I've got to do it. Oh, this is hard. Oh, I've got to try. And we can change that mental state into everything's okay, everything is fine, no problems, no worries, this is good. Wow, I'm glad I remembered to to stop worrying. Because there's nothing worth worrying about. If we can do that, then the next job would be to start relaxing the feelings. Now, we can do these various objects one by one as they occur. One of the examples would be to start having thoughts about right here, right now, everything is safe. It's not dangerous. There Dhammadas is laying in bed. Dhammadas, is that bed dangerous? It's not. But you're not having any thoughts about what a nice bed this is. It's not dangerous at all.
Yeah, it's
Michael,
just feel good.
You're sitting on the porch here. Is that porch dangerous? Only when I'm looking at you, huh?
It's completely safe.
And yet we don't have a thought about it. We don't recognize. We go around feeling danger because we think of dangerous things. But the reality is that right now, everything is okay. Cat, is that cootie that you're in right now, is it dangerous?
Sometimes there's a lot of snakes around, but it's okay. Right now, it's okay.
Ah, but when it's dangerous, it's because you bring something in that's dangerous, a thought, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, so we can begin to remember to have thoughts of, I'm actually safe right now. I can begin to feel safe right now. I can begin to feel comfortable right now. The body is comfortable. The mind is comfortable. Can I eventually start to feel comfortable? So the bed is comfortable. The body is comfortable. Do you feel comfortable, Dhammadas? All right. So start thinking about it in the next while I'm talking here. And think about feeling safe and secure, feeling comfortable. That this is actually pretty good stuff. So allow ourselves to feel safe, secure, and comfortable. You don't have to follow a lot of rules to feel safe. But in fact, while you're following the rules, that means that you might break one. You might not be safe. But when you forget all about the rules, you can just be safe. Safe, secure, and comfortable. And this leads into the next item, which is the hot dog, the big zinger, is that you can feel satisfied. This is an important word within the context of the teaching of the Buddha. Satisfaction, becomes satisfied. Why? Because that is just the opposite of being dissatisfied, which is the entire teaching of the Buddha, is to see your dissatisfaction and come out of that dissatisfaction into a state of satisfaction. They become satisfied. That's all there really is to it, is to become satisfied. And so these are the various objects that we have in Anapanasati, is to feel. And how are you going to feel? What is your object? You can take the object of, I'm satisfied. You can take the object of, I'm safe. You can take the object of, hot dog, everything is just hunky-dory. Everything is great. These are the objects that we want to actually take, not some mud pie or some stargaze to gaze at. But that's one of the big changes of the Buddha, is that all of the people who were meditating in the time of the Buddha and his own practice also with the Kasina meditations, the charnel ground meditations, and all of that, even metta meditation, may all beings be happy and such, are objects outside. They're not within you. They're outside of you.
Sorry.
A mud pie, a set of leaves, water, crystal gazing, fire meditations, these are all external objects. And so the major change that the Buddha made was to change the objects that people were taking on into internal objects, inside the body, inside the feelings, inside the mental states that we have, inside the thoughts. Kat, you had a question.
Yeah, I heard you say charnel grounds. Do you mean like death contemplation or like body, looking at bodies and stuff like that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, the charnel ground meditations were what the Buddha, to be honest with you, there's a sutta where the Buddha gave a bunch of monks a charnel ground meditation. He went away, he came back a while later and asked one of the monks, and he says, you know, why are they so thinned out? And the answer was, is that they really practice their meditation and now they're in the charnel ground. And so he stopped practicing the charnel ground meditations. It does take us out of sensual desire, but it's an extreme. It goes too far. That we're trying to live life right now. And the charnel ground meditations were pointing out that things change. You're going to die, but you don't have to die right now. Goenka also has changed that into the sense that he's got a couple of old videos of autopsies. Can you watch an autopsy? The answer to that is that it depends upon if we identify with the body that's being cut up. If we think, oh, it's me that's being cut up. Or think of it like this, like someone has a really bad broken arm, a compound fracture. If the doctor says, oh, poor you, oh, that must hurt so bad, the doctor is getting squeamish, he's not going to be able to set that arm. A good doctor is not my arm that's broken, it's an outside arm that's broken. Here, let me pull that bone back into place. Okay, and so when we identify with, we go into someone and we see them sick and we say, oh, poor you, you're sick. We begin to get sick because we identify with someone who is sick. What we need to do is to stop identifying with outside objects and start identifying with, but not really identifying with, but rather investigate what's on the inside so that we can see the body becomes comfortable, safe, secure, and relaxed. And then the mind can become safe, secure, comfortable, and relaxed. And then the feelings will become safe, secure, comfortable, and relaxed. And then our thoughts will genuinely be thoughts of being safe, secure, comfortable, and relaxed. So these are the objects that we are going to pay attention to. Now, let's go to what Ivan had to say. But before we do that, does anybody have any questions about objects of meditation?
Damaso, I have a quick one.
All right.
When it comes to objects of meditation, like when I do anapanasati, sometimes I like to keep my eyes open for some reason. And like I just naturally maybe just focus on, you know, some mundane thing like a leaf or whatever's in front of me. I think because earlier on you mentioned something about the main point of is to focus inside, but sometimes I like to focus outside, but not really, but my thought is empty.
Well, the eyes open doesn't mean that you're actually looking. But in fact, I would say that a good meditation teacher teaching students in the beginning will say that it doesn't matter whether your eyes are open or not. That in fact, the Buddha images that you see so commonly in Thailand and other places around the world, the eyes are half closed. And so the instructions would be that if the eyes get heavy, let them close. It's also okay to let them become half closed so that you're, from the outside appearances, your eyes are closed, but in reality, you can still see. But in fact, that's what happens with a lot of magic tricks. You've ever seen people become blindfolded? And then they're completely blind. Have you ever been blindfolded? I mean, literally, when you were a kid playing games and whatnot. Guess what? Yeah. I was blindfolded with the blind, but I wasn't blind. I could find some way of seeing. Rub your nose and rub the eyes, and now you've got a so that you can see out. That I remember that, you know, I could always play those games with the other kids because I could see, even though it appeared with the blindfold, that I could not see. Often with blindfolds, you can actually see through them. You can see shadows and shapes and movements and whatnot, that kind of stuff. When I was in India at some ashram or another, I remember that they played those blindfold games. And I remember that I could actually see through the blindfold, not necessarily with the eyes, but I remember in one particular time and place to where there was a big kind of strange, really weird object right out there. And I mentioned it to the person that I was with. And then I took the blindfold off, and you know what it was? It was a great big pile of bicycles. People had left them, you know, they were parked and then more parked and then more parked, and they were jumbled up and just all kinds of big mess. But I could see through that blindfold with some sort of inner eye to see. And so the whole point then about our eyes is that there's more to vision than just the retinas and lenses and things like this, that you can, in fact, see. And that what I would invite people to do then is to begin to see their own thoughts, to begin to look at what's going on, that you can look at how you feel. You can look to see if you're comfortable or not. You can look to see if there's objects around, even though the eyes are closed. You can still, in fact, you can see right through your eyelids. You can see shadows and shapes and all kinds of things. And so whether your eyes are closed or not, or half open or not in meditation, is not really a question. It's not an issue. What is the issue is, what are we with our inner eye actually looking at? What is our focus of attention? What is our object of meditation? So this is the a way of beginning to understand is that it has to do with a way of looking. So that you can feel things. You can hear things. And with that, you can see. Here's another example. When I was a kid working on motorcycles and working on cars, I began to appreciate automobile mechanics of the 1960s. And everybody was an automobile mechanic. I mean, you would never take your car to a dealer, because dealers are a bunch of thieves, and so you never take your car to a dealer, you fix it yourself. And so everybody winds up being able to put a screw into a nut-like place or inside of the car engine without being able to see it with your eyes. Your hands become your eyes. You can feel your way through things. An example would be, here's Lucky laying on the floor, and while we've been talking, generally when I'm talking to people, she comes up, and this is the time when I remove ticks, and I do not look for ticks with the eyes. It's all done with the experience of the hands, and I know exactly what a tick looks like because I feel it with my hand. I can feel how big it is. I can feel which direction that it's laying, whether there's a group of ticks around or whatever like that. And I developed that skill when I was a teenager by learning how to thread a bolt, or actually thread a needle through a thread a needle without looking at the needle. You can find out how to do that with your fingers. You can feel your way through life. This is basically what we mean in kind of a meditation situation, is don't necessarily rely on the eyes to see. Get some sort of inner eye, some sort of feeling eye, some sort of mental eye, to where you can begin to see things without relying so much upon the eyes themselves. Okay, now that's a fairly long answer to your question about should you close your eyes or not. And the answer to that is that it's kind of irrelevant. That in fact, really, you could say is that what we really want to do is open that inner eye to all, the Hindus talk about it as a third eye. They even put kumkum on their temple, or not the temple, but the mid forehead. And that in fact, this is something that I have been told, and I used to practice it, is often touch that point, tap on it, begin to get that thing active, to recognize that you've got sensations other places in the body, and begin to become aware of that inner eye so that you can see things at a much deeper level. That we think of the eyes like the physical eye sockets and things like that is to see things on the outside. But here we're going to be focusing on turning things inwardly, and we need a new kind of a vision. Okay, to start looking at what's going on the inside, to start looking at what's going on with the body. It's a matter of touch. That in fact, sight and touch doesn't have quite the boundary that you would think it is. That there's a middle ground in there to where sight and touch are the same thing. The same way with sound, that touch and sound are very deeply related. That in fact, elephants are well known that they hear with their great big potted feet. And so the story on this regard is that in December of 2004, there was a huge tsunami out in the Indian Ocean. And when that tsunami hit Phuket, a whole lot of people, Westerners mainly, got caught in the flood. Hundreds, if not thousands, of people died. But we didn't lose one elephant. Why? Because the elephants could feel that earthquake. They knew something was coming, and they headed for the hills. This is a famous story in Thailand, by the way. But they hear through their feet. Okay, can you begin to hear with your body? Can you begin to see with your body? Can you begin to have that feeling sensation that takes in data? In other words, when somebody comes to the door or somebody's in the yard, you can feel that they're in the yard. Maybe sometimes before you see them. But you can hear them. And that sound feeling combination is sometimes better than the sight itself. And so this is what I would say with our practice in, is learning to take objects. But when we take an object, how do we take the object? How do we take it is with this inner seeing, feeling, sensing system. We begin to feel our way around the mind. We begin to feel how we feel. We begin to sense what state of mind that we're in. But this is something that they talk about a lot in the Satipatthana Sutta, about knowing what state of mind that you have. Most of everybody doesn't pay attention to the state of mind that we're in. We think that the mind is just the mind and it's always in that state. But in fact, the mind itself can be in various states. In the sutras, they talk about, is the mind dull? Is it sharp? Is it elated? Is it depressed? And what I would add to that is the mind a victim or is it a winner? This is how we begin to look at our attitude. And when we look at our attitude, we're not looking at our attitude with our eyeballs. We're looking at our attitude with the way that we're feeling. And so bringing in that sense of touch, that sense of getting in touch with the body, that in fact almost all emotion is expressed in the body. Anger is in the body. Anxiety is in the body. Fear is in the body. Can you sense it? Do you know how you feel? This is one of the objects then that we could take in meditation. This is all part of Anapanasati, is to get really in touch with how you feel. See it. Sense it. Investigate it. And in this regard, that means that we're going to actually bring up a new kind of skill of sensory awareness. We're going to learn to sense things in ways that we couldn't sense before because we weren't practicing, we weren't noticing, we weren't paying attention. And so this is actually what meditation is. So when you ask the question, can I go to not having an object? The answer to that is, let's take many things as an object. One by one as they occur, start paying attention. Start moving from object to object to object. Note it well and let it pass and go to another object. And know that you're taking an object. Know what object you've taken. Note it well and then move on. Let it pass. Thanks, Ivan, for bringing that issue up about what do you do with your eyes. You begin to use them in a new way. So does anybody have any questions now? Yes, Anne.
You said almost all feelings have a body sensation, but which one not having body sensation, if it is?
I'll leave for you that to investigate.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, go start to investigate. When you're anxious, feel that anxiety in the body rather than just calling it anxious or calling it uptight. When you're uptight, feel that the body itself is uptight.
I know this part, but you said some of them not in the body. I'm asking about those who are not in the body. I thought all of them in the body, all feelings are in the body, but you said some of them no. My question is, what are those?
Well, if I said that, I'll back off on it. Because we are a combination. We're not just a body, and we're not just a feeling, that the feeling and the body are intertwined or interrelated. If you didn't have a body, you couldn't have any feelings. And if you didn't have any feelings, you wouldn't have a mind. All of these things are interrelated. that in fact, when you start to think of something and you have a bad feeling about it, that bad feeling is going to be a chemistry change. That's another way of talking about it, is using the word chemistry, that a certain thought pattern has a certain chemical system. That chemical system then begins to move around, so that the chemicals that are in the frontal cortex will very quickly start working with the cerebellum, with the amygdala, then to the pineal glands, and now down to the adrenaline gland, and now the bud is changed, the body's changed, the chemistry's changing. You can't have a thought without it having a chemical reaction that manifests in the body. So taking that as information, let's go investigate that. Let's begin to see that the they interreact, so you can relax the body and that'll relax the feelings. Or you can have uptight thoughts and the body will get uptight. You're a system. And everything touches other things in your system. It's all interrelated. So, Michael, I see you with a big grin. Do you have anything to say? Your mic is muted. Okay, now you got it. I can hear you over here, but I don't hear you here.
I know there you go. This has been really wonderful so far. It kind of points a little bit to this idea of where does the wind begin and where does the feeling begin whenever the wind touches your skin, you know. There can be sort of this investigation of like, oh, you know, there's this wind brushing against these sort of skin cell atoms. But then I would almost say that it's like, we don't need to get too obsessed with that at the same time, at like understanding all of the details about the feelings arising necessarily. We can just like, be satisfied with the process and be satisfied and just keep taking in the data.
Right. Process. Or as you're saying, not attached. That's what I was meaning when I was saying, note it well and let it pass. Move to another object. Right. One by one as they occur. So instead of saying, oh, I'm going to take one object of meditation, like the, let us say, the toenail on the cross, let's start taking a whole lot of objects, knowing that you're taking different objects. Move from object to object to object. That in fact, that's the kind of concentration, is to be able to keep steady movement, to keep doing it, keep doing it, keep doing it, rather than getting too tightly one focused. Taking one object and going so deep into that one object that you, in fact, get lost. Big, the Ajahn Po was really big on that, is to be here now means to take in a lot of different sensory input and process it rather than getting stuck on one little thing. To be awake. To be here now means that you're taking in a lot of sensory data through the body, through the mind, through the feelings, through all kinds of senses. This is what the waking up process is, especially taking note of, is this dukkha or not? That's the first thing to start looking at, is this dukkha? Because if you can see dukkha, you can do something about it. And if you can't see it, then you're just an ordinary person living their lives in an ordinary, unsatisfying way. Caleb, any thoughts? Any last remarks?
Me?
Yes.
I just really liked how earlier you had said, rather than using the breath as an object, you just used the train of thoughts as a set of multiple objects, each with a sequential flow in time. And I like how you said that rather than having a steady concentration on a single object, you want a sort of active concentration that's able to handle the thoughts as they come.
Mm-hmm. That'll give you a new perspective in how to practice. All right. So, Damodas, you have any last remarks?
Just thank you so much.
Okay. All right, guys. Well, let's finish the talk now. Go have a good object. We'll see ya.
See you, Dr. Arthur. Hi, everyone.
Hey, everyone. Have a good one.
Namaste.